to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 19th year. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we sit down with Alan Feldman, the chairman emeritus of the International Center for Responsible Gaming, on his induction into the AGA Gaming Hall of Fame. It's not a coincidence that after Alan Feldman retired from MGM Resorts as Senior Vice President of Public Affairs, he continues to make a huge impact on the gaming industry in his roles with the International Center for Responsible Gaming and UNLV's International Gaming Institute. He's that important to the industry. Feldman was recently inducted into the American Gaming Association's Gaming Hall of Fame for his years of service with Mirage and then MGM Resorts. He has always been a leader in the industry, representing the industry and recognizing the importance of responsible gaming. He sat down with me for a recording in the conference room at UNLV's IGI in October. Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast. My guest today is Alan Feldman. Alan is the Chairman Emeritus of the International Center for Responsible Gaming, and he's also the newest member of the Gaming Hall of Fame of the American Gaming Association. Alan, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on
that. Thank you so much, Roger. I appreciate that.
I mean, it is a big honor. You know, you have spent your career helping companies and their owners get their message out before the employees, before the community, before the shareholders, and suddenly the focus is on you.
It was both awkward and humbling and just an incredible honor. And you know, for me, I feel as though I've had a front row seat these last 35 years,
right,
and have had the privilege of meeting and working with, or at least getting to know, quite a few members of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, absolutely.
Never once in my wildest dreams thinking that I'd be part of that group.
Yeah.
Because I really hold them all in such high regard.
Right.
It was a little overwhelming.
For sure. Well, I interviewed Jim Allen right before the mm-hmm. ceremony, and he said, I can't believe I'm one of the 114, people, of the millions of people who have worked in this industry. There's only 114 in this Gaming Hall of Fame, and he took it as a great honor.
Oh, absolutely. And I, obviously I know Debbie really well, worked together for many, many years.
Right.
And we had compared notes when we found out that, again, neither of us ever thought that would happen. If anything, we were, hoping for others.
Right.
We'd nominate others.
Right.
No question. Advocate for others. But anyway, here
so
we are.
I've heard this story before, but tell it for our viewers and listeners how you got into the industry. It's a great story.
Completely by accident. I worked for a PR firm in Los Angeles, and I had there was a consumer division and there was a business division. And I sort of had, my own little operation in the corner of clients with kind of odd problems or the clients were odd.
Right.
It was one or the other. And it turns out that Steve Wynn had hired a PR firm, was dissatisfied with them, terminated them, and then went asking for another recommendation. Mm-hmm. And the recommendation happened to be the place I was working. One day the boss comes out of his office and I'm just sort of walking down the hall kind of randomly. And he says, Feldman, we're going to Las Vegas. And I didn't exactly see that as a great thing.
Right.
I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up as a kid coming to Vegas in the late 60s and 70s, when there really wasn't much to do here.
Sure.
And kids were kind of openly not welcome in their own way.
Right. Yeah.
So I didn't have the greatest sense of what Las Vegas was. But anyway, off we come to Las Vegas on a Wednesday in late September of 1989, and we meet Steve and Elaine Wynn. And for 6 hours, we talked. We talked in the office, then we went to lunch and talked, then we went back to the office and talked. Still hadn't seen the Mirage.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that the city that they were describing, the market that they were describing, that they thought Vegas wanted to go and become, was completely different than what was here. And I stress this all the time, nothing here was broken.
Right.
There was no, it was a successful, thriving tourist destination. Mm-hmm. But what they knew was that it appealed to a sliver of the traveling public,
right.
not only in the U.S., but around the world. Mm-hmm. And that was the white space, if you will, that sure. they wanted to start to fill.
Right.
And, you know, even on opening day of the Mirage,
sure.
It was said, if we've got this right,
yeah.
if this business model works,
right. sure.
a whole bunch of other folks are going to come to town
yeah.
and look what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we ended up completely transforming the town
right.
Over the course of years, our company and many, many, many others
sure.
who made great investments, who expanded the market even a bit further.
Sure.
And so here I went from, oh God, we're going to Vegas to
right.
now having lived here 35 years and
right.
have watched my family grow. And I'm very, very proud of our town.
Right, exactly. So as someone who worked for Steve Wynn in Atlantic City, even before he built the Mirage, I know he had a special relationship with his employees and a special relationship with his executives as well, in which he could be difficult with the executives and the employees.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
he was great with the line employees. But, you know, I've seen him, you know, go off on a couple of executives.
Yeah.
And he could be difficult. So
yeah.
how did you kind of, you know, push him toward decisions that he might have not have wanted to go? Did you have success doing that, or did you just have
on
to
occasion,
go with the flow?
No, on occasion, you,
yeah.
you kind of knew which levers to pull. You know, sometimes it meant talking to Bobby Baldwin.
Right.
And then Bobby could pull Steve aside mm-hmm. and have a conversation. It was very different than any of the rest of us.
Sure.
Elaine was also a huge, huge, huge factor
sure.
in all that went on
right.
in the company. But also a very big help in
yeah.
helping me understand how to manage Steve.
Right, right.
And I will tell you a story that I don't think I've told before, but there was one of those moments where, you know, on Monday, Steve was so thrilled with something I had
right.
done, and I was the best PR person in the history of PR, which was never true. On Tuesday, something went south, and now I was the worst scum of the earth.
Right.
And, you know, he made both,
right.
you know, with equal zeal.
Sure.
And so I went to see Elaine, and I just said, you know, how am I supposed to respond to this? Because I'm really not certain. She said, when Steve gets excited
yeah.
and loves you, mm-hmm. he loves you in an unbelievably big way.
Right.
You're on top of the world.
Right.
But you're not.
Yeah.
And when he's giving you a hard time, you feel like you're at the bottom of the world.
Yeah.
But you're not. Your job is to ride the middle. Don't go up with mm-hmm. him when he gets excited. Don't
right.
go down with him when he gets frustrated. And I will say this. Steve probably never got more upset than when he was frustrated, and especially when he believed someone could have handled something better.
Sure, right.
And that frustration came out as explosive anger sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that advice, don't get too excited
right.
about
yeah,
it.
Sure.
Don't get too depressed about it. Just ride the
right.
middle.
Yeah.
Turned into a, you know, 10, almost 11-year career
sure.
with that company.
Sure. Absolutely. So the Mirage closed earlier this year.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people, you know, citing the memories they had of the Mirage. What's your special memory that you have of the Mirage?
Oh, it's all, for me, it will always come back to the people. The,
yeah.
the employees who were there were, you know, this was my first entree into the gaming industry, Las Vegas hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
I had a glimpse of it at the Golden Nugget while we were in the run-up to the Mirage, but that pretty quickly became
sure.
being physically at the Mirage every day. And I'd never worked with people who were that consistently interested in helping and being supportive and wanting to raise the bar on the quality of what
right.
they were doing,
mm-hmm.
even as they were doing it. And the disparity or the delta, if you will, between Las Vegas hospitality and any other city in the world came absolutely ringing through because we did a lot of boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd go to L.A. and do a boxing press conference. Or
right.
we'd go to San Francisco or we'd go to New York
mm-hmm.
several times.
Sure.
And every time that happened, and you'd work with hotel staff in those cities,
right.
in some fabulous hotels,
yeah.
but it was difficult. They
sure.
threw
yeah.
obstacles in your way. They mm-hmm. said, oh, no, we can't do that.
Right.
Whereas every single time we dealt with our team at the Mirage or the Golden Nugget or later mm-hmm. Bellagio and Treasure Island, it was always about how do we get that done? Yeah. How do we make this happen? Mm-hmm. I literally once asked the head of the AV department, we'd set up a huge riser, probably 40 feet in length,
right,
for television crews at a boxing press conference. Mm-hmm. It was off by about 10 feet of depth. And the crews made an absolutely legit request if we could move it 10 feet to make those camera angles right. work better. Yeah. And this thing is massive. And I went to Tim Sage and I said, Tim, I really hate to ask you this, but can that be moved 10 feet? Nah, no problem. Sure enough, 30 minutes later, it was moved. Yeah. And every one of the photojournalists was thrilled.
Right, right.
But it was always about, you know,
right.
Well, how do we do this better? How do we make this work? How right. can we help? Mm-hmm. And never a hindrance. I love the people exactly. at the Mirage.
So there were incredibly talented executives there, and you included, yeah. who have gone on to become leaders of the industry in many of the companies and casinos around the world. Why do you think it was such a fertile ground for that?
I think it's in large part because if you look at what Steve and Elaine did at the Mirage, they didn't invent any of it. Right. In other words, you know, there was convention business in Las Vegas. They didn't invent yeah, sure. that. And there were restaurants and there was retail mm-hmm. and there, of course, was casino. What they invented, if you will, was more of the attitude of service
right.
and giving guests an experience that they would take home forever. Mm-hmm. And I think that perspective, as opposed to being worried about the gambling.
Right.
You know, Steve himself used to always say, never sweat the action.
Right.
Sweat the customer.
Yeah.
Make sure the customer's okay. Mm-hmm. Make sure they're having a good time in whatever they're doing. And the gambling will happen.
Yeah.
The gambling will come. You mm-hmm. don't have to worry about it.
Right.
Folks will gamble. You don't yeah. need to show them the casino, force them in the casino, you know, entice them with all kinds of craziness. They'll figure it out. They right, know where right. it is, and they'll go in
well,
the room.
In those days, you also had the kind of the rule that the employees could make the customer happy no matter what it took.
Well, that was a very big, you know, sometimes the smallest gestures get the biggest
sure.
response. You know, we talk in a service industry, we talk about customer recovery.
Right.
Right. Something happens, something goes south. How do you recover mm-hmm. from that? And in most companies, the recovery process requires sort of moving up the ladder until you finally get to a supervisor, a director, whomever has the authority
right.
to take care of this.
Sure, right.
And of course, that authority is usually something
yep.
mm-hmm. really minor.
Sure.
At the opening of the Mirage, Steve gave every single employee comp authority. I don't remember what the dollar amount was, but it wasn't much.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like they had thousands of dollars.
Sure, right.
But like, you know, if it was something like $10 or $15,
yeah.
just do it,
yeah.
right? Just comp the drink. The drink
yeah.
wasn't good, comp the drink.
Right.
The meal wasn't quite right, comp the meal or comp a dessert.
Right.
You didn't need to ask anyone. You didn't need to you know, fill out any papers.
Right.
Well, that created a sense of ownership. Those mm-hmm. employees were on the one hand very willing to give something to recover a
sure.
customer, but they were also very careful about how they did it.
Right, right.
And so that I think that there was a perception in some executive circles, oh my God, you can't do that. Everyone's going to be giving away money left and right.
Right.
Yeah, didn't work that way
yeah,
at all.
Right, yeah.
At all.
Yeah, that was great. So let's talk about the sale of Mirage to MGM. That was extremely unexpected. You know, I mean, I was shocked when I heard it. No one would ever think that Steve Wynn would sell the company that he put his heart and soul into, but there it was. Tell us what happened, how you were involved in that.
Well, I was involved in a weird way, you know, kind of literally right in the room. I found out about it. Frank Farenthoff called me
yeah.
at, I was like 6 in the morning out, yeah. out in the West here.
Right.
He said, have you heard? I'm like, Frank, it's 6 in the morning. I haven't heard anything. And he told me. And yeah, I was pretty shocked. I think yeah. all of us were. as you know, the stock price had been dropping, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that the assets really had been stable,
sure,
and, if right. anything, growing. But there came this moment where the folks at MGM realized there was great value yeah. in this. There was some back and forth about valuation mm-hmm. that was all incredibly friendly and professional. This was not, I've heard people talk about it as a hostile
right.
takeover. Let me assure you, there was nothing hostile right. about this. Did Steve want to sell the company? Right. No.
Yeah.
But there came a moment where the offer on the table was the right offer. Mm-hmm. And our financial advisor said as much. The board agreed. There was, you know, they sort of just negotiated to a point where it made sense to yeah. sell. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so Steve and Elaine weren't planning on leaving. No one was. But it's not like it, you know, it set them back.
Right,
I mean, all
right.
they did was go and create two more spectacular properties here and then in Macau and now in Boston.
Sure.
So, yeah, it's done very well for everyone.
And the transition seemed to be pretty smooth, you know, in terms of, you know, sometimes, you know, especially MGM, even at that point, was a bigger corporation than Mirage.
No, it was the other way around.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, no, Mirage was a considerably
okay.
bigger
okay.
company than MGM. But here's one of the things that matters. You know, the very first day that the mm-hmm. team of executives comes over from MGM,
right.
it's Bill Hornbuckle.
Yeah.
And you know, Bill's an old friend. For you know, there were 400 of us in a ballroom,
right?
And Bill starts speaking, and it's like speaking to a, you know, our brother whom we haven't
right.
talked to in a little
right.
while.
Yeah.
And Terry Lanny, who is just one of the greatest human yeah. beings
classy,
ever,
classy
to
guy.
Say nothing yeah. of all that he did as a business person, but
right.
just as a human being, what
yeah.
an extraordinary man! And you know, and just and good people,
mm-hmm.
Danny Way, John Redmond, these
sure.
were good
right.
people. And, you know, Steve made a wonderful speech that morning saying, you know, we weren't looking to leave. We
mm-hmm.
weren't looking to sell. But we will say this. You're in good hands.
Right.
We are leaving this place head held high, knowing that we did some great work. And you're going to continue to do that.
Right.
And these folks are going to help you get there.
Mm-hmm. And the great thing was that most of the executives stayed on when MGM
yep.
took over. I mean, I can't think of anyone significant who didn't stay. And your title changed from PR to public affairs. But what's the story behind that?
Well, so part of it is just that the work had changed. When I started, I was really doing the marketing PR
right,
for
right,
the company.
Right.
I'd be a little bit supportive around quarterly earnings, but to be honest, don't tell anyone, please. I didn't really understand most of what was written in those press releases.
Yeah, right.
It was unintelligible as far as I was mm-hmm. concerned. So I was mostly dealing with,
okay.
you know, the shows mm-hmm. and the restaurants, the hotel,
right.
et cetera. As time morphed on, it became more and more dealing with issues,
mm-hmm.
dealing with industry issues, gaming industry issues,
sure.
Working with the AGA, working with U.S. Travel, and expanding our footprint within the travel industry. And then other issues that happen when you just get to be a bigger company.
Right.
You know, you have labor issues, legal issues, all that stuff. So I was beginning to deal more in that
right.
realm. And it's a slightly technical change of, you know, of definition
right.
from public relations to public affairs.
Mm-hmm.
But we made it because it was true. That
right.
was the work I was doing. And then through the 20 years with MGM Resorts, you know, my work got further and further away from supporting the marketing efforts of the company because
sure.
Jen Michaels was there
right.
and frankly was better at it than I ever was.
Mm-hmm.
And so she took off and ran that part.
Sure.
And I stayed on dealing with development, going
mm-hmm.
to new communities, introducing ourselves, introducing the industry, and trying to help us and the industry grow.
Well, that's the time you became involved with responsible gaming, correct? I mean,
yeah, that started pretty early on, in part because development was becoming more
sure.
and more of a thing, as
right.
you know, in the early 90s, especially up and down the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing, amazing rapid growth of the industry.
For
Mirage, we were looking at other opportunities, not there. We were in Connecticut, we were in Florida, we were in Vancouver, British Columbia, trying to work on various opportunities. But it didn't matter whether it was, you know, those three places or up and down the Mississippi. Problem gambling came up at every meeting, and it usually came up first.
Right, yeah.
And in the early 90s, there was very, very little known about it. And even within the psychological community, there was pretty strong disagreement about what exactly this was. That it was behavioral solely was sort of the general rubric that folks had of it. Of course, later we would find out that genetics plays a role. Brain function is, of course, the critical piece. And, you know, we've learned a lot more. But what it required was making an investment in this, because our federal government does not acknowledge gambling.
Right.
You know, now we know it's a substance. But the federal government still doesn't acknowledge it. So anytime the federal government says we're gonna put research towards substance abuse, it's always substance abuse except for gambling.
Right. Yeah.
And by that I mean literally that's how it's spelled out in law.
Yeah.
So we're on our own as an industry. And the only way to do this was to find a way to, for the industry to pool some resources and then step back from it and not be engaged.
Sure.
And, you know, those first couple of years I know were hard for some folks. I mean, it was, they're all business people. They, you know, they put money into something. They want to know what's going on and they want to know, you know, they want to dictate the outcome or try and manage the outcome. And with the International Center for Responsible Gaming from day one, it was like, no, you're not doing that.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to put the money into a pot, and then scientists are going to take over
from
there.
We'll see you later.
Yeah.
And tell you how it turned out.
Right? Yeah. And so even though I know that there is still to this day controversy about industry-funded research, the thing that I find the most interesting is that no one has been able to point to any work that ICRG has done ever and say the results there are influenced by you, the fact that you had industry money. And the results of work that we've been doing in the U.S. through ICRG and other means of doing research have turned out to match the results that we're seeing in other parts of the world.
Right.
So while Australia and England are all up in arms about industry-sponsored or industry-funded research, they're getting the same results.
Right.
So, you know, at some point here, we gotta have to understand that the U.S. is going to be different until or unless the federal government removes these restrictions on funding and treatment for gambling is also prohibited. You know, you can't get reimbursed from Medicaid if you're a clinician. So there are a number of issues that are unique to the United States. Make no mistake, I would love for the gambling industry to have access to some of the billions of dollars that the federal government puts into substance use work. There are a number of things that would be extremely beneficial to our more than just our industry, it's really to the communities we all serve. Because those impacts are out in the communities. So it would be great if we could do that and get into these really, really, really large surveys, the kinds that they tend to do with drugs and alcohol.
So while you're at MGM, you introduced the GameSense program. I had the opportunity to see that early on. I went up to Massachusetts interviewing Steve Crosby at the time. He was chairman of the gaming board up there. And we were talking back. Let me show you this. And he walked me down the hall. I talked to their head of their responsible gaming unit. And he sent me down to the Plainview racetrack. And I actually saw it in action. And it was pretty impressive. So what was it that convinced you that it would work for a big company like
The funny part is I was in the midst of working with our advertising department to create something that MGM would own. So it would be our own program. I didn't know GameSense existed, but was really headed down the same road. And then Mark Vanderlinden, the gentleman you were referring to,
Steve introduced me to
In Massachusetts at a G2E, asked if we could have a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. So we got together and he said, hey, I just want you to know you're going to use GameSense in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
That's going to be your responsible gaming program. And I think I think my reaction was pretty much what any other business person would do or company executive. Right. I got pissed off.
Yeah.
Like, who are you to tell me what program? I went back to the office and I'm like, GameSense, who the GameSense? I got to worry about GameSense. And I finally, GameSense.ca, boom. And it was instantly exactly what I was trying to accomplish.
Right.
Not because I'm so special, but because it was very clear to me that was the direction that this needed to move in.
Sure.
That we needed to be having ongoing dialogue with customers about healthy play. Mm-hmm. That's responsible gambling. Once you have someone who needs help, who needs an 800 number, who needs to get online quickly with a counselor, that now you're into problem gambling and there's only so much to be done about that from an industry perspective.
Sure.
What we can do is talk to customers about how to keep this fun and affordable.
Right.
And fun and affordable to me represents health.
Yeah.
That now you're playing in a healthy way. You're playing in a hopefully harm-free way. Another way of saying it is in a safe, you're gambling safely.
Sure.
And I don't really look at responsible gambling much differently than I look at skiing and ski slopes, ski resorts.
Yeah.
They put up signs. They tell you, well, this one's a bunny hill, and this one's a blue thing, and that one's a black diamond, and this is a triple black diamond, right? They're letting you know up front, risk, higher level of risk, higher level of risk.
Right.
Now, that's something that I think as an industry we can get a little more transparent about. Now, think about any time you hear an ad for someone who's selling, I love that they call it securities.
Right.
You're investing in a security. That sounds pretty secure. Yeah. But it's always followed by investing in securities involves risk.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I sometimes wonder whether or not we should just be that, that open. I mean, that is gambling. That's what gambling's about. You're taking a risk.
Right. So when you found GameSense and it came before the board, I mean, this was going to cost millions of dollars. You had to train thousands of employees all across the country. Did you get any pushback on that?
None. In fact, I think I had 12 slides in a deck. Yeah. The 12th was the money.
Yeah.
By the fourth slide, I had approval.
Yeah.
And I even remember saying, this was, this was our chairman, Jim Murren, COO, Bill Hornbuckle, our Dan DiRigo, the chief financial officer, John McManus, critical person, general counsel, Corey Sanders. I mean, the whole group. Doug Seidenberg, the entire group was like, oh, yeah, we want to do this.
Right.
And I literally said, don't you want to know how much this is going to cost? And they were like, well, yeah, okay. Show us the work. The fact is that this is an industry that has been spending millions of dollars on this topic. It just hasn't accounted for it. It hasn't taken the time. It does now.
Sure.
The AGA does a really good job
of
saying to companies, what are your expenses in these areas? So, having GameSense is a multi-million dollar annual cost to the company.
Sure.
But we were already spending, 60, 70, maybe even 75% of that was already being spent on other things.
Right.
So there was an incremental spend that needed to happen, but it's all been worthwhile.
So why hasn't GameSense itself spread across the industry? I mean, every casino company has its own responsible gaming program. They're kind of very similar, Why can't everybody get together and agree on one thing?
Well, number one, I don't know that that's actually a good idea. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that as an industry, we compete.
Yeah.
And that competition allows us and causes us to innovate.
Okay.
So to only have one to just, pick the winner, I get concerned you sort of end up stuck there. Mm-hmm. I love the way GameSense is designed in that you have all of these licensees around North America.
Right.
Any one of them is allowed to put new creative into the mix as long as it's shared equally with everyone else. Mm-hmm. I would have thought others would have picked up on GameSense.
Yeah.
I would have thought others would have followed, I think what's ended up happening is that a lot of the companies have looked at the precepts of GameSense, at the you know, foundational elements, and have tried to incorporate those into what they're doing.
Okay.
But I do love GameSense, and I'm not suggesting I wouldn't choose it again.
Sure, right, right.
I just don't know that, that you know, having a singular answer to this is particularly healthy.
So, you know, after you retired, you were named chairman of the ICRG, and then now you're chairman emeritus, obviously. So they value your participation. I know that for a fact. But
I appreciate that.
So do you think that organization is responding to the issue as completely as it could?
Well, I think it is responding to it as completely as it can.
Yeah.
Based on its funding.
Right.
You know, again, I think that part of the challenge for gambling in America right now is that we need to go much, much, much further in funding the research and funding understandings of how gambling plays in society. And about the only, the challenge of having these smaller budgets is that you've really got to set your priorities. And I think for the last 25 years or more, the priority has been understanding harm.
Right.
Understanding the harms caused by gambling. How do those harms manifest? How do they actually change over time?
Mm-hmm.
How do you resolve whatever harm you may have?
Right.
So that's very understandable. With the money we have, that's really got to be the focus.
Sure.
Where I think we really want to go is into a much broader analysis of gambling and health.
Mm-hmm.
How does gambling interact with our societal needs, our social needs as individuals?
Right.
What role does it play in family dynamics?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of gambling that goes on that isn't even considered gambling. Well, you and I were talking about the World Series.
Right.
Let me assure you, that was a time where my dad and I could have been 14 years old.
Yeah.
There would have been 50 cents or a dollar on any of those games.
Of course, right.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Not an amount of money that's going to change either of our lives.
Right.
But the point is, that was part of our familial experience.
Sure, I played poker around the kitchen table with my family.
Right?
You know? Yeah.
And I think that gaining a broader understanding of how gambling plays into daily life and into health.
Mm-hmm.
There are some benefits to gambling.
Sure.
And I don't think we really... You know, I think we understand them in a very superficial way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's fun.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But how and why and what's happening, you know. I know that as silly as it is, a $5 wager on a game gets me much more involved in that game.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
Right. Now, I'm in a very blessed position that I don't have to worry about the $5. If I lose it, I lose it.
Right.
And just for the record, I usually do.
Me too.
But I'm engaged in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I keep hearing a lot right now about how horrible parlays are. This is a really good example.
Mm-hmm.
Parlays create even more of a social dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're not watching one game, you're watching two. You may be watching three. You may be watching more than one sport.
Right.
And you're probably doing it with friends. And who knows, maybe the friends took the other side of that parlay and you're, you know, there's banter going on back and forth.
Sure.
I just think that we're missing a more detailed, granular understanding of the entertainment value and even the social value of gambling.
Right, okay, great. And you mentioned parlays, that's happening now on online gaming and on online sports betting. Which, of course, is booming across the country. Just set a record in New Jersey. New Jersey's been had online gaming since 2013, and it's grown every year substantially. How is this going to affect the research into what you just mentioned, gambling? Obviously, more people are exposed to it now. And in fact, I just read the demographics of the sports bettor are just what the casino likes. And you know,
yes.
You know, 25 to 40, you know, and so how is that going to affect, you know, research into the gambling?
Well, I think that we all need to be mindful of the fact that this is new.
Right.
What isn't new is sports betting isn't new. We've
right.
been betting on sports for well over 100 years in this country, actually significantly more
right.
than 100 years, and on sports around the world throughout history.
Right.
So the idea of sports betting isn't new. It's just the access, the availability, and in some cases, the speed. Mm-hmm. We've got to keep an eye on this and make certain that it isn't causing people to get into some trouble.
Right, right.
What's interesting is that the initial studies of large data sets from sports betting companies shows an incredibly similar pattern to gambling in general, mm-hmm. which is the vast majority, something like 98%, have very low levels of engagement. And what I mean by that is either the money is very low, it may be regular, it may mm-hmm. be $5-$10 a week.
Sure.
Or it could be seasonal, right? You have people who bet football who don't bet on anything
sure.
else.
Right.
But the point is that the numbers, no matter what, are reasonably low.
Mm-hmm.
What you end up with, though, at the 2% is, I mean, you would talk about off the chart. You see the line of average bet or average number of bets
right.
a week, and then you get to the end, and it just shoots up.
Right.
As an industry, we need to be mindful of what mm-hmm. that is.
Right.
It may be people who can afford it and are having a great time, mm-hmm. and that is their entertainment of choice.
Sure. Right.
Absolutely. It also could be people who are getting into
sure.
trouble. And I think we're going to gain more and more insight as we look at these data sets. We're going to gain more insight into how to intervene, when to intervene,
mm-hmm.
what the messages ought to be.
Sure.
But, to any sports betting company, if, out of nowhere, you have someone who's, just putting 20,000, 30,000,
sure.
40,000 in, if it were a land-based casino, you'd probably know real fast who
yeah.
that is.
Mm-hmm.
You'd probably sure. know where they work, where they live,
right.
if they're married, do they own a business, are they just a sharp investor?
Mm.
You're going to know a lot about them. I think we need to be doing the same online. We've really got to get to know
the
these
good thing
people.
About online, it's transparent. I mean, you can see every bet everybody makes.
It is, and the question is that information being acted
right.
upon?
Right, exactly.
Right. That's
sure.
that's the thing.
Yeah.
And we all want good customers. We all want folks who enjoy this, who are able to afford it. And the converse is we also don't need people burning out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we've got to, I think we've learned that in the land-based business. There are a number of different ways you can kind of help a player manage
right.
their experience. I think we still have a little ways to go in understanding that online.
Great, great. Well, Alan, you're retired, but you have so many things in the air. We're here at UNLV, where you're a distinguished fellow. You're the chairman emeritus. You speak at conferences around the world. I'm glad you're still working in the industry and you're still able to help us.
I am honored to still be working in this industry. It really has been a privilege to be in it, and I'm as passionate as I am about this because I want to help make the industry better.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks for taking the time to sit down with us.
Pleasure. Thank you much.
Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you want to learn more about the issues discussed today, visit GGB Magazine or sign up for free to the daily GGB News Global Gaming Monitor at ggbnews.com. Don't miss a single episode of the GGB Podcast. Subscribe on Amazon, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB Podcast.